W-E-T-E-N-P-C.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Nope. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. It's Tuesday and you're listening to Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Tim has a day off. We will be getting back together within the next week, working together on these shows as soon as he is up to it and mobile and able to get going. So again, keep him in your thoughts and prayers for continued healing on his foot. It means a lot to all of us. Thank you very much for tuning in. UFOs. Listen, this is something that fascinates our listeners, and we get so many downloads of the UFO and alien episodes. I'm always looking for a different angle and a different way to open up a dialogue about this, because to be honest with you, after 12 years, there's not a whole lot of new stuff coming out. There's not a whole lot of new theories or ideas, and I wanted to continue this conversation, but maybe do it in a different way. And when I got the promotional slip for our guests today, I thought this will be a good conversation, because their PR press release started off with, if you like your UFO literature to confirm what you already know, this is not the book for you. And I knew these would be the guests I want to talk to today. So we're going to dip into the world of UFOs, but we're going to do it a little differently. And joining us today, Robbie Graham has lectured around the world on the UFO subject and has been interviewed by the BBC, Coast to Coast AM, of course, on Darkness Radio last year, Channel 4, Vanity Fair, among others. His articles have appeared in numerous publications, including The Guardian, New Statesman, Film Facts, and 40 and Times. He holds first-class degrees in film, television, and radio studies, and cinema studies from Staffordshire University and the University of Bristol, respectively. He is the author of Silver Screen Saucers, which we talked to him about last year. He's here to talk to us about the new book, and joining him, Susan Demeter St. Clair, is a professional research assistant, author, editor, and psi experimenter. Her research interests include individual and institutional responses to anomalies and exceptional human experiences, and how they interact and enact change within groups and large institutions, such as the military. Her life took on the framework of UFO experience after an encounter in 1990, and she considers anomaly studies to be her true life's work. She's here as well to join us tonight as we talk about this fascinating subject. Thank you both for joining me today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us on the show.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to people that have different concepts and thoughts and ideas on what we're dealing with. And Robbie, let me start off with that. You know better than anyone, there are a lot of books out there and a lot of documentaries and films regarding UFOs. What did you want to bring in the new book? What did you want to convey to readers that would be different than what we've already been, you know, exposed to over the 50, 60 years?
Really, over the past 60 or 70 years, has been characterized by an obsession with the extraterrestrial hypothesis, which obviously posits that the UFO flying saucer phenomenon is the result of extraterrestrial visitation and interactions, physical entities in mechanical physical vehicles visiting us from other planetary systems. And that theory has been hugely popular because on the face of it, it does have natural logic. We know increasingly that the universe is likely to harbor some form of life, given the scale and given the rate at which we're discovering new planetary bodies in extrasolar systems. And so, you know, theoretically, it's very plausible that we are not alone in the universe. And given the age of the universe, of course, we can comfortably speculate that some of these life forms may have evolved to our stage and well beyond. And then, of course, it remaining purely speculative, it's possible that some of these life forms may have managed to find their way across the galaxy to interact with other species. So it does have some considerable logic. However, the logic starts to get holes punched in it when you start to really address the nitty-gritty of grassroots UFO reports. And so we'll get into that in terms of the high strangeness, I think, during this interview, hopefully. And what we suggest in this new book, UFOs Reframing the Debate, collectively as 14 different contributors, is that the UFO phenomenon may very well not be what it appears to be. It may be more complex than just extraterrestrial visitation. Indeed, it may not involve extraterrestrials at all. None of us rule out the ETH conclusively. In fact, none of us draw any conclusions at all about the phenomenon. But what we are interested in doing is presenting alternative perspectives on UFOs and how we might more usefully study the phenomenon in the 21st century. So the idea was to bring together some of the more, I would consider them to be some of the more progressive and iconoclastic thinkers in and around the UFO field for a critical deconstruction of what constitutes popular ufology today, looking at how we arrived at the assumptions that many people hold dear, looking at the processes through which ufology has become a belief system, and looking at, what's actually left to study when we break down the belief system, what's actually there. And so it's critical, but it's constructive always, and it represents, as I say, a range of differing and I think crucially even conflicting viewpoints. None of the contributors in the volume seem to quite agree on the best approach, and I think that's where the book has its value, because you'll find very conflicting viewpoints presented directly side by side within the book, and so the reader is encouraged to draw their own conclusions, and the goal is that by the end of the book you're feeling quite lost almost, so that you start to ask your own questions and look for a new direction.
Right.
So yeah.
You know, it's funny. There's a meme, internet meme, that's being passed around right now, and it actually spoke to me. I know it was supposed to be done in a comical way, but it says there's a guy laying in bed with his girlfriend. All of a sudden, he sits up and he's panicked. He goes, "Oh my God, there are no UFOs."
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
Alien, Area 51 does not exist. She's like, "What are you talking about?" He said, "If it were true, Donald Trump would have tweeted about it by now." And
yeah,
and for God's sake.
Assuming that the president would know.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think you'd trust Donald Trump with much of anything, really. So I don't think you're going to give him those kind of secrets. But yeah, surely if he'd have got wind of it, it would have been tweeted by now.
Susan, talk to me a little bit about your experience, please. Tell me what happened with you.
My personal experience or yes. The essay?
Yeah, I'd like to know about the personal experience before we go into the aspect of the essays.
Oh, okay. Absolutely. Because it's something that I would say is what kind of put me on this path to researching and contemplating UFOs. When I was 23 years old, I had a UFO experience, a close encounter that involved a nuclear power plant. And it was witnessed with my brother-in-law. We were watching a movie together, and my then husband was asleep on the couch, and we were just watching this Elvira, Mistress of the Dark film, when I realized it was getting late, and I went to go and lock these sliding glass doors to this balcony. At the time, I was living in like a 10th floor condominium complex, and it overlooked Lake Ontario and the nuclear power plant there. And I had small children at the time living with me, and it was my habit to lock the doors. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I got up and I saw immediately out the window this large, bright, glowing object. It was very red. It was almost like in the shape of an octagon, and it was pulsing. And it was out over by the nuclear plant. And I was just at first, like, I was just shocked and gobsmacked. And I thought, is this a reflection on the window, or what is this thing? And I opened up the sliding glass doors and I walked out and I looked at it for a couple of seconds and I called out to my brother-in-law and he came out and he was looking at it and we both kind of looked at each other. And as my mind was like trying to come up with some sort of an explanation, a rational explanation for what we were seeing, he said to me, "I think we're seeing a UFO," or "this is a UFO." And I just, there was this, just the hairs on my arms were standing up and we were, I was just in such a state of shock and I just blurted out and I'll never forget this and I don't know why I said it, but I said, "They know we can see them." And soon after that, it was like this giant object that was just sort of pulsing imploded on itself and literally shot up into the sky. And prior to that, I had no real interest outside of pop culture in UFOs, but after that, I was sort of driven. I mean, we didn't sleep that night. We sat up, kind of, both of our minds were blown. What was this? What did we see? Still trying to discount, you know, what it could have been. And that, to me, I have written later on, as my own ideas on UFOs have evolved since that time frame, because this is going back to 1990, I've since written that I almost view that as an initiation, just as an initiation into another type of thinking, another way of being. And it really has, the whole UFO topic has sort of guided my life in very strange and synchronistic ways, and still does.
When you first saw this, to the minute it shot off back to space or wherever it was heading, how long would you estimate that the entire encounter lasted?
It wasn't long. It was only a few minutes. But it was
Robbie,
enough.
Listen to how disappointed she sounds. Yeah, it was only a few minutes. Some people just get that fleeting shot across the sky. You got to call your brother-in-law to verify it with you. That's amazing.
Yes. Yeah. No, it was actually, in terms of UFO sightings, it was fairly lengthy in duration, and it was so close that there was no mistaking. It wasn't like just a quick little light or a blip in the sky that I viewed for 10 seconds, and it was not that high in altitude, I estimated at the time. I wrote everything down. Now, this is pre-internet, so I didn't know who to talk to about this. And I wasn't going to call police, but I did the next day. I went through all the newspapers and I did that for the following few days thinking, oh, someone had to have seen this, something, right. You know, this was so huge and miraculous and I couldn't find anything. And I eventually went to the library and I took out some books on UFOs and I found Alan Hynek's book and I wrote a letter out to QFOS in Chicago. And unfortunately, at the time, I didn't realize Dr. Hynek had already passed away. So the letter was returned to me as undeliverable. And I kept that. And it was great that I did that because now I have the record and I had the exact date and time and the circumstances of what happened. So that was pretty much where it was. And then I just started reading and getting involved in UFO organizations, and it just sort of snowballed for me from there.
Susan, did you happen to research the facility that it was hovering above? Had there been any issues with it leading up to or after, immediately after that encounter?
Yes, actually, I did. Many years later, I was able to find a lot of information, and through the help of the organization MUFON at the time, that there had been a history of UFO reports involved with that particular nuclear power station and nuclear generation stations and nuclear other facilities as well. At the time, I didn't know that, but this all came about later, and I found that quite fascinating.
But was there any specific information about the facility itself? Like, had there been power outages? Had there been a possible leak or contamination? Anything that happened prior to or right after your incident?
Okay. Now I understand what you're saying. No, nothing that I could come up with that, like an anomaly with the station itself as to why perhaps it was there. No.
Robbie, this is a weird aspect. I mean, we've heard of these craft appearing over nuclear facilities, over missile sites, and that they seem to just have this carte blanche ability to come and go And what's very strange is in most cases, they're not being chased by the, you know, Tomahawk missiles or by black jets or black helicopters. They just seem to be there witnessing or experimenting without any recourse, with no attack, with no plan. How is that even possible? Especially in the last 20 years since 9/11, people continue to see these things. How is this not more of a fascination for the world, do you think?
That's a very complex question.
That's all right. We have an hour and a half. Go for it.
So first of all, these manifestations, UFOs, however you want to characterize them, mm-hmm. aerial manifestations, anomalies, yes, there is a history, a documented history of them appearing over sensitive government and military, you know, particularly military facilities, nuclear bases, as yourself and Sue have mentioned. In terms of possible, can we even ascribe motives to these things? Are they thinking things? Are they piloted? Are they some form of psychic manifestation of the collective unconscious? These are questions that we ask in the book, and not, mm-hmm. and as I say, there are no solid conclusions to be drawn. Obviously, the popular theory is that these things are piloted extraterrestrial craft taking an active interest in Earth's nuclear ambitions, and that's possible. But we simply have no proof of that. We just do not know. And as I say, when you look at the look in depth at individual close encounter reports, particularly because things start to get very different and far weirder when you compare, for example, a nocturnal light sighting, like Sue talked about, which even had an aspect of high strangeness to it, as Sue talked about, that possible psychic connection. But what you'll find is that those elements of high strangeness intensify. You know, 100-fold when you start to look at some intense close encounter sightings. The closer the object to a witness, the stranger things seem to get. Is this a result of some form of extraterrestrial intelligence or technology? Possibly. Is it something weirder? Is it something closer to home? Is it something that has far more to do with the subjective experiencer than it does with something that might be externally occurring? Is it something that's co-created, as one of our authors, Greg Bishop, speculates? So we're sort of really trying to push the boat out a little bit in terms of the questions that we're asking. Going back to the question that you asked there with relation to why isn't this more of a global fascination? Well, I think it is a global fascination, but it's not a legitimate global fascination. That's the difference. It is a massive. It is, you know, the UFO has taken the global culture by storm. UFO themes, ideas dominate Hollywood narratives and have done for many decades, in particular over the past 3 or 4 decades. A lot of subcultural ufological discourse and ideas taken directly from the literature and debate in the field has been sort of snatched and used and utilized and exploited by creative minds in the entertainment industry and popularized through the lenses of cinema and TV. And so it's become part of our popular culture, and everyone has some concept of what a UFO might represent, albeit probably a skewed and simplified perception. And that's the result of narrativization through the media. But so it is absolutely a global fascination, but because it's become so intrinsically associated with fiction and with science fiction in particular, fantastical forms of storytelling, it's very hard for it to get a foothold in official culture. And so it's always been pushed to the fringes. And that's another one of the ideas that's explored in the book by one of our other authors, MJ Benias, who talks about how UFOs always sort of struggled to gain legitimacy within official culture in a capitalist system. So you've always got this dichotomy where UFOs seem to be real and treated seriously by governments around the world, particularly the US government, as is evidenced in tens of thousands of declassified files, which we now have access to. Clearly, the government treats the subject seriously, or have done in the past. And millions of people seem to have experienced UFOs in one form or another. But at the same time, you won't see any serious reporting, or you'll see very little serious reporting about this subject in mainstream news media. And that's another, issue in itself that we could debate at length. So,
well, see, that's where it gets hard. I understand from the media prospect, and even doing the show for the last 12 years, is what you're dealing with is somebody's subjective opinion or thoughts on what they witnessed or someone that they know witnessed, or you know, what somebody witnessed that was relayed to them at another time. It's hard, I guess, as a journalist to go out and take it seriously because, let's face it, they don't always just appear on cue. It's not like the news camera and crew can go out and film a location, boom, there's the UFO. They can get in detailed, you know, visualization of it and then, you know, research and break down what it is that we're seeing.
Right. Well, it would seem that the phenomenon, whatever it might represent, almost consciously defies serious scientific, you know, rigor, serious scientific analysis, just as you think you've got close to kind of putting a glass over it and studying it, it kind of squishes itself out from under that and slides away in this sort of tricksterish fashion. To quote Greg Bishop, who's one of our authors in the book, he asks the question. He says, how much do we bring to the dance during a paranormal encounter, including UFO encounters? He says, in other words, how much of the UFO experience is the result of our subconscious minds trying to make sense of unexpected, startling, and or frightening input and leaving us with an insane placeholder when it can't decide on anything else? So that suggests that there may indeed be something genuinely anomalous underlying the UFO phenomenon, perhaps some kind of intelligence, not necessarily extraterrestrial, but that what we're seeing, what we're experiencing is so far beyond our everyday experience and so far beyond our normal comprehension that we add layers we add cultural interpretive layering to what we're seeing in the moment and after the fact in our telling of these experiences, and so that what we actually eventually report to an investigator and then what that investigator reports to, you know, to their colleagues and to the world may be very many steps removed from what was actually experienced in the moment. So this is something that has to be taken into consideration as well, that the complex processes of human cognition, which are little understood really. So we're sort of advocating that more attention be focused inwards on us. What role do we play in shaping these experiences? Because the temptation and the trend is typically that people who have UFO experiences, and certainly ufology as a whole, sees UFO events as something that are external to an individual witness and that are happening to them, and that we are basically just sort of passive spectators removed from the experience itself. But that actually does a disservice to the human, you know, to human potential. You know, anyone who's studied any aspect of human cognition or consciousness will testify to the fact that, we are extremely complex and
right. Sometimes we don't give ourselves enough credit for what it is that we're truly capable of or of experiencing,
or even manifesting subjectively, sure, or even objectively. And so what we see is often very different to what is actually there. So, and especially, you know, when confronted with things at the peripheries of normal everyday experience, such as UFOs or other paranormal phenomena. So these are questions that we ask, but
I liken it to a dream state almost. Like, mm-hmm. if you look at some of these, I'm just going to quickly interject, but even within my own first experience with that UFO, when I began looking at the description and what I was seeing and applying it to things that were going on within my own life at the time, to be honest, I noticed I'm seeing a giant stop sign in the sky. It was red, it was pulsing, but it was also an octagon shape. At the time, I didn't even really consider that at all. But there was symbolism there that later on, when I began looking at other UFO reports and considering them almost in a dreamlike sense, where you can have dream content, which appears to be one thing, but actually it's symbolic for something else. And I think that too could be playing in with this whole idea of co-creation and how the witness is relating to a phenomena It may not appear. We may be seeing a spaceship, but that doesn't mean necessarily it is a spaceship, if that makes sense.
No, I understand that completely.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your essay aspect of this, Susan. What did you bring to the dance with this with the new book, UFOs, Reframing the Debate? What did you want to explore in your essay with this?
What I'm arguing for is UFOs as more of a parapsychological event as opposed to a nuts and bolts, say, spaceship. And I'm also arguing for more attention being paid to the UFO experience, what's going on with them at the time that they're having this experience, mm-hmm. and perhaps in their greater social context of what's going on when we consider the larger UFO events such as the UFO waves. That's pretty much what I'm bringing to the table, is that I think that in some cases that the paranormal aspects of UFOs, and this often happens, these very high, strange, absurd things that could be likened to poltergeists or apparitions, telepathy, synchronicity. In some cases, that's sort of pushed aside because it seems really weird. Even from the witnesses themselves, they often don't really like to report it right off the bat because they know it sounds crazy. Yet, these strange things that are going on seem to be part and parcel of the greater UFO experience. And as Robbie had mentioned, the closer you are to the UFO, the stranger these things seem to manifest themselves. And they can manifest themselves leading up to the UFO or even days or years later, where people are having UFO experiences and then finding that their houses become haunted or things of that nature, which just it seems to be a lot more complex and paranormal related than it is like just a nuts and bolts kind of view of an alien species coming to visit us. So I speak to the absurdity and wanting to focus in more on that and those types of details and see what that may bring to the table, using parapsychological models and lenses to examine these cases.
Well, then, with that, knowing that, and that's kind of the perspective you take on this. Now, it was not just a solo encounter. You had your brother-in-law. He witnessed the same thing. Did you front-load him? Did you say, do you see that red, design in the sky? Did you tell him what you specifically saw? Or did he come out and just corroborate what you had already seen?
At the time he corroborated it, I didn't know what to say. I might have pointed. I probably would have pointed at it and said, what is that? Or what the heck is that? I might have even used stronger language.
Well, what do you make of the symbology?
As for the description in that, now his is slightly different in how it left, okay, and how we lost sight of it. He didn't see it shoot right up. He saw it implode. But the basic description in that, no, we both kind of came to that ourselves. So we were seeing the same sort of thing.
And once you saw this, I mean, what do you make of the symbology then? If two people, independent of one another, saw the same image, same colors, and, you know, for the most part, 95% of the experience was identical. What do you make of that? Because I understand the idea and the perceptions of, let's review what that individual was going through at the time of that moment. How could their mind have perceived this? What was going on? What made them more open to witnessing at this time? What drew their attention to that sky to begin with? You know, there's a lot of different aspects of that investigation. But what, now that you're applying this theorem in the essay, what do you make of your experience and that of your brother-in-law?
It could have been symbolic to myself and then projected over to him. It could have been symbolic to us both. There could have been symbolism for the greater society. Like you said, maybe something happened in that nuclear plant. Maybe there was some safety issue or something that never got reported that we never knew about, that all of a sudden there was, hey, this stop sign, hey, you know, like stop over the nuclear power plant. This is a great question, but unfortunately I can't really answer it. And even if I could, even if I knew that maybe something was going on in the greater social context around that nuclear plant, or in society in general, I would only be speculating at this point as mm-hmm. to the symbolism behind it. I can't with 100% certainty say that this is correct. I'm just sort of, I'm putting that out there as an alternative way of thinking towards the,
We ask a lot of questions throughout this book, throughout the individual essays, and the answers to most of them are not provided, but if they were provided, the answers to almost all of the questions would be, I don't know. And that's why it's quite radical, because most UFO books will give you very clearly defined answers. They will ask questions and provide answers. But of course, those answers are, for the most part, wishful thinking based on blind belief, and with absolutely nothing to support them objectively. So what we're simply trying to do is raise questions, interesting questions, and then lead people down other avenues of inquiry, highlight problems, methodological, organizational problems within the UFO research study field, address, common assumptions and see how valid they are. And then we sort of break things down, and we are quite harsh. I declare ufology to be broken or non-existent in the first few lines of the book. Ufology as a term really lacks any meaning, because the whole field has just been in constant disarray since the late 1940s.
Well, we need to take a break. Let's come back and talk about that. What do you believe is in disarray specifically? And how can we address that? What can we do to start to turn this around as we continue reframing the debate on UFOs? Our guests this evening are Robbie Graham and Susan Demeter St. Clair. We'll continue this talk here on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
UFOs reframing the debate. It's a cold, hard slap in the face for ufology, delivered with love, according to the people behind the book. And we're talking with two of them today. Robbie Graham is with us. He was with us on Darkness Radio as we talked about saucers in the cinema about a year ago. Susan Demeter St. Clair also with us as we talk about this. Before the break, I kind of threw the question out to you both. What do you make of the current state of ufology? What are the inherent problems that you're seeing specifically? And how do we start to fix this so that the debate and the search for real answers starts to get taken a little bit more seriously? And Robbie, why don't we start with you on this?
So I think, first of all, I mean, I've used this word several times already during this conversation, and that's assumptions. The field, the so-called UFO field, is today is built on 60, 70 years of assumptions, very simplistic ones, which are hooked around the extraterrestrial hypothesis, and which has been built into today what's known as exopolitics, which is sort of the blanket acceptance that the UFO enigma is the result of aliens visiting us, and crucially that the government, the US government, knows this full well, that the government has all of the answers, or most of the answers, to the enigma, and that indeed they are even in treaties with extraterrestrial civilizations. They have reverse engineered technology, and that all we need do to understand UFOs is to pressure the government through lobbying and petitions to the White House, et cetera, et cetera. And eventually, in the not too distant future, the government will eventually see fit to release all of its UFO information, and the world will be changed overnight, and a new age of cosmic enlightenment will be ushered in. So ironically, the UFO field, which for so long has deeply distrusted officialdom, actually looks to officialdom for ultimate truth and salvation. They say, without saying it, they're basically saying, we deeply distrust you, but the day that you decide to release all of this information, we will accept what you have to say. And we will accept it with open arms and trust everything you have to say. Right. So it's this dichotomy, it's this complete paradox. And that is essentially the disclosure movement. Now, I you know, I think it goes without saying that the US government and other governments will obviously be sitting on highly classified UFO information. They seem to have taken it very seriously over the years, and I don't think for a minute that they've released even a fraction of the information that they have. Do I think that they will ever, you know, do I think that they will ever release everything that they know about the subject? No. And even if they did, I think it would be foolhardy for anyone to believe that the sum total of the government's knowledge of UFOs would come close to scratching the surface of what the phenomenon actually represents. So, you know, people look to systems of power for ultimate truth and enlightenment and enlightenment on the subject. But what we're advocating is that we need to start to take things down to a more grassroots basis. We need to form smaller UFO research groups rather than large ones, which tend to become incredibly bureaucratic and ineffective, such as MUFON, for example, and other international UFO organizations. Taking things down to a more localized level, but also looking not so much outwards, but inwards as well. Again, looking at the role of the individual experiencer, looking at human potential and what human potential brings to the UFO experience. But also, as I say, trying to the extent that is possible to shed assumptions and beliefs, because the UFO subject, the UFO phenomenon, although I'm convinced is objectively real, for whatever that might mean,
right.
It is undeniably a new age belief system, and you know, so this is a thematic thread that runs through our book, this idea of belief, and you need to be able to examine how this belief system has been created through cultural layering, through covert political encouragement to some extent as well. You know, what we have is so for example, like one of the contributors called Jack Brewer, he notes that a great deal of completely inaccurate and often at best unverified information is widely accepted and then spread as if it were reliable. This pretty much characterizes ufology. He says we then tend to form beliefs and make up our own minds about things which haven't actually been adequately explained. And then he says, and people subsequently not only reject revisions and corrections, but tend to actually embrace the beliefs even more tightly when those beliefs are shown to be incorrect. And that's not just for UFOs, that's across all sorts of religious beliefs as well. Another one of our contributors called Lauren Kutz, he talks about this thing called the UFO mythological zone. And he defines it as the gap between fact and belief, what we see and what we want to see, what we experience and how we interpret it. He says that people are forming highly personalized variations of the one core belief, the belief in a fundamental UFO reality. But he says that all else is up for individual interpretation via this UFO mythological zone. He says, in the absence of facts, many people simply choose what they want to believe. And that is very much the case with the UFO field. That seems to be a profoundly true statement. So we encourage people to the extent that's possible, to shed preconceptions, assumptions, beliefs, and to start asking challenging questions of themselves. Challenge themselves with new material, with new ideas. I used to think quite differently, very differently about this subject, and my mind has been not changed because I've still not reached any conclusions, but it's been shaken out of quite a rigid belief system, and it's very easy to fall into a belief system with this, because UFOs are inherently, you know, they seem to be symbolically divine. You know, they represent some higher form of intelligence, some higher power that can potentially offer salvation, and so the religious parallels are obvious, and so it invites belief. And in ufology, where a subject like UFOs, where we really don't have any definitive scientific proof for what we're dealing with, in the absence of conclusive evidence, what we are left with is belief. We all believe one thing or another, whether it's skeptical or you know, very gullible, we, you know, and anything in between. We all believe something about the subject, myself included.
But isn't that how science approaches any kind of investigation? And Susan, I don't know if you want to weigh in on this, but people will have repeat experiences. They'll hear from different people and they start to form a hypothesis and a belief system regarding this. You know, when I met with James Gilliland out at the Trout Lake Ranch, the Yosetti Ranch, he told me this is what I found. This is what happened to me after I experienced this and what others have experienced. And I put that to the test and I was finding the same thing. Now, again, because he preloaded me with this and told me that this is how others have experienced their UFO encounter and processed it, did he plant the seed that that would automatically be how I would perceive things going forward?
You know, possibly, yes.
Right.
And that's the thing, is that on a personal note for myself, I too, at the very beginning, because I had no real experience outside of pop culture with UFOs, thought that I was seeing some sort of an alien spacecraft or something. This had to be ET, because I had seen Close Encounters of a Third Kind and ET and all that. And later on, as time went by with my own research and that, I started questioning myself, and I realized that the reason I knew that it was ET behind UFOs is because I wanted it to be. And that took a lot of soul searching, but I realized my belief was based in a want, because I grew up in the era of the space race and the Apollo missions, and I was a huge fan of Star Trek, and I wanted to be that first girl astronaut out there on Mars, and I wanted it to be aliens. I really did. And when I realized that it was my want was fueling my belief, it freed me from the ETH, if that makes sense to you. And getting back to science, of course, it's you can have you have your hypothesis, so you have your question, but how can we test the UFO question? Really, we don't. From a materialistic science standpoint, we don't have a craft. We don't have an alien body. We can't, you know, do autopsy. We can't. You know, there's very, very little in the way of physical evidence. There is some, but it's fleeting. It's occasionally they come up. We get radar hits on them. I don't believe a military has ever shot one down, although I think they've tried. But there's very little in the way to physically examining the UFO. So science is very difficult to apply a hard science to these cases. And there are, of course, and we're getting them after the fact. There are some UFO hotspots, like there's Hestalen in Norway, where they're doing some good science. And occasionally they see, like, structured or shaped-looking spaceshipy crafts. But it's mostly anomaly lights. And whether that is truly related to one and the other, we don't know. So it's very difficult to apply, like, a hard materialistic science to the UFO question.
And it is interesting, right, how the preconceived notions, when you look back at the 1950s and the saucer phenomena, that's what everyone saw. You weren't getting really reports of giant flying triangles. You weren't getting reports of these, you know, football field long, you know, 10-story tall building-like UFO craft that were flying overhead. It all seems to change, and a lot of the reports of the grays really didn't start until the Communion book cover, which, if I'm correct in assuming that was part of the you know, became part of our lexicon, became part of what we expected to see. And then you saw it in movies like Close Encounters, and now that's what most people encounter. When people from the past encountered them, a lot of the times they just described very human-looking alien creatures.
Either completely human or absolutely outrageous, you know.
Right.
Sorry, Sue.
That's okay. No, I was just going to say, the grays are very popular, and speaking of, like, to global fascination, you're going to be hard-pressed to find anyone on the planet that doesn't recognize the gray logo, and that's the simple gray alien. That's universal. You don't even have to have a language at that point. It's a symbol now. But depending on culture, you can have all sorts of different. It's the same with ghosts. You can have all sorts of different pilots, you know, and some of them are very small and dwarfish, and others are giant robotic creatures. And I there's must be thousands of them that have been reported, and they change as well based on culture, I think, and circumstance and time frame. I think that Dr. Kripal found the first gray, really, or what appeared to be like a gray alien already in the 19th century. But you're correct. They really were popularized, I think, with Whitley Strieber and Communion.
Yeah, slightly before in Spielberg's Close Encounters in 1977. That was the, but you only saw them, you didn't see them in detail, you more saw them in silhouette at the end of Spielberg's Close Encounters. And that was the first time that any cinematic product had featured this crystallized, now iconic gray alien in short in stature, large head, spindly body, etc.
Which I think is important too, that a lot of people don't realize, and I like Whitley Strieber. I think he's a fascinating individual. But he is, to ufology, I think he is one of the biggest, oh boy, I got to be careful how I use this terminology, right? Because you can piss off a lot of people real easily today.
Hey, well, but Whitley is interviewing me in a few days.
Right. Well, and like you said, he's a fascinating guy, but he's kind of a dichotomy in himself. He's in conflict. We've interviewed him numerous times. And in some, he refers to them as the visitors, and they are to be he's terrified of them, and you are to be cautious around them. And in a more recent, he's like, no, I'm not afraid of them, and they're, you know, they don't mean us any harm. And and then in the next breath, he's kind of explaining the fact that, well, you know, we can't just, you know, I can't really even say that these are aliens. I can't say that they're creatures from another planet. And I'm a novelist. I'm an author. I create. And was he inspired by what he saw in Close Encounters? So we have to look at where we get our information. As you said, you know, some people just vomit it out there and somebody reads the vomit and then it becomes fact to them. And then they reverberate that vomit throughout the internet.
To really take it into more detail, we mentioned the Close Encounters aliens there. They weren't just the imagining of Steven Spielberg. Those gray aliens in that film were the direct result of production designer Joe Alves on that film interviewing real UFO witnesses. He went to grassroots UFO witnesses, close encounter witnesses, I guess abductees, though they weren't really and this was the image that emerged from speaking to dozens and dozens and dozens of close encounter experiences. And he got the same description from quite a lot, and then from those reports he put together this image of this, what we would basically see as the archetypal alien gray, and then he based his design on that. So actually his imagining was based on real life reports. That's not to say that those real life reports are true or accurate, but that's what he did. It wasn't just something that he conjured in his own imagination. So that's interesting.
I bring that up in my essay as well, that the movie in many ways is a good callback to what was going on in that time frame, because Alan Hynek was the consultant of the film, and it was showing paranormal-like events that people were actually, you know, describing and relating back. So actually, that's the title of my essay is based on the Close Encounters film. So I think that it's important to note that it wasn't that the grays came out of that. It was more that the movie came about because of all these experiences that had been documented in many in Blue Book that Alan Hynek had worked on for the U.S. Air Force.
And isn't it intriguing, though, now you look at the way that they describe these beings, and now we're starting to hear more about, could we colonize the moon? Could we colonize Mars? And you start hearing about what the effects of the human body would be in extra long space travel. And they're saying that the arms and legs could atrophy because of the way the blood will circulate, because of the gravity, because of this, that, and the other. And when you start listening to the way they describe how it will affect the human form, and then you look at this long history of how aliens have been described, it's pretty intriguing to me, because then all of a sudden you start to see what science is just talking about now is exactly what we've believed these creatures look like that are supposedly traveling through the universe. Long, spindly arms and legs, you know, exaggerated chests and abdomens, heads, things like that. So to me, that's kind of a fascinating aspect of this whole evolution of ufology and how science is almost catching up to understand why these creatures may appear the way they appear to us.
It is, but then at the same time, there are so many different types, or have been historically so many different types of entities mm-hmm. reported in association with UFO close encounters, that some of them you would just think, well, how is that an alien? You know, some of these things seem more like gnomes or like,
or like, beautiful ladies, the Nordics, you know,
or even goblins and things like that. Goblins that fly, you know, and come into your room and steal your cookies at night, which is one of the examples that's used in this book. You know, these are the high strangeness aspects that seem like something out of a cartoon, you know, and the witnesses themselves, they experience, but as Sir had mentioned, they when they come to report these events, they feel that particular aspects of them, these high strangeness aspects of them, the things that are really laugh out loud silly, but which are nevertheless they have experienced or feel they have experienced, they censor themselves in their reporting of these events because they feel that particular aspect of their report would discredit the rest of it. So they censor themselves, and then even if they don't censor themselves, the investigator for an organization, whether it's an independent investigator or for an organization, the investigator will often censor those or omit those aspects of the report because they feel that would discredit the report, and they are seeking legitimacy for ufology, which is built on case studies. So they censor those aspects or they omit those aspects from reports, and so you're getting a wealth of data that's just being lost, sidelined, ignored, relegated, and buried because it just seems too weird to fit with the nuts and bolts ETH, the extraterrestrial hypothesis. Some of this stuff just seems more paranormal. As I say, Sue had mentioned the poltergeist connection. There are a surprising number of UFO cases that seem to be directly associated with poltergeist phenomena and other psychic phenomena as well. And Sue could talk a lot more about that than I could.
But Sue, isn't that interesting that a lot of people that experience these UFO encounters then will experience other paranormal phenomena, usually sightless, things where they don't witness, they don't see the ghosts, but there are sounds, there are things moving about in their home. You know, they'll have these experiences. It almost seems like perhaps we're mistaking what we've thought in the past were ghost-like activity or PK could be alien influence that they're just cloaking or hiding themselves. I mean, that's kind of a fascinating aspect to this as well, that we may not have any of this right. Right? I mean,
exactly. How about vice versa?
Right.
I mean, there's an entire, Hillary Evans is one of the people that had influenced my thoughts on this. And he wrote a comparative study on the entity Enigma where he compares all sorts of apparitions from the alien visitors to ghosts to visions of the Virgin Mary, things of that nature. And it's a very extensive comparative study. But there are a lot. Now, they're not all identical, but there are many aspects of all of these types of experience that are the same when you start peeling back the narrative and the story of what people are perceiving, which seems to be influenced almost in a co-creative way by the person's culture and their personality. You can see these differences. So it could even be working in reverse. We honestly really don't know what is behind the phenomena itself, but they do occasionally dovetail. And in my essay, I do cover a case from Woodstock, New York, where a couple rented a house, and within the house, they were having all sorts of knocking, like poltergeist knocks. They were having disembodied voices. They saw an apparition of a man. But at the same time, while all this was going on, they were seeing these light balls out in this field that had left like little circular, like we call them saucer nests, like almost very basic or crude crop circle. Like this was back in 1966. This was all very extensively investigated by a parapsychologist by the name of Scott Rogo. And you could look at it, I mean, depending upon your own belief system, you could describe it as a poltergeist case, or you could describe it as a UFO case, because it has elements of both. So, you know, maybe it's one and the same, I don't know. But I'm arguing for that sort of highly strange, absurd information to be included when we are seriously considering these reports. I want all the data. I want all the information, no matter how crazy and absurd it might sound. I think that the perhaps better questions are going to be formed out of taking in this more strange information. And that's kind of where I'm at, is I don't want an answer at this point. I want better questions and maybe a little bit better of an understanding. And I'm hoping that's what the book will do as well, is stimulate people to think and maybe trigger them in different areas. And maybe we'll get other people coming up with some really interesting ideas towards what this might be.
Tell me real quickly, Robbie, with all of these different essays and all of the different authors you have that are a part of this book, although a lot of them have conflicting ideals and thoughts on what it is that we're dealing with, are there common threads that also run through their essays?
Yeah, there are. I mean, the common thread is that they're all skeptical, in the sense that, so for example, about three of the essays are written by what you would term experiences, or what they would consider themselves, at least close encounter experiences or experiences, of the UFO phenomenon. They've either seen things close up or experienced things directly that they consider to be non-human intelligences, but they don't draw conclusions about what it is they've experienced or are experiencing. It's an open question for them. But even those people who actually consider them experiences within this book, even they are skeptical compared to a lot of the people within the UFO field, who like to draw conclusions, who like to sit firmly in one camp or another. These people do not conclude. So one of the themes is just a constant thread of skepticism, and a refusal to conclude, or, you know, throughout. One of the themes, again, is the role and the power of belief, in shaping you know, how belief has shaped the UFO subculture, essentially, because it is a subculture and it's a New Age religion. The power of belief. One of the consistent themes is, you know, questioning the extraterrestrial hypothesis without outright rejecting it, offering other possibilities. One of the themes is, well, at least one of the recurrent ideas is taking to task, shall we say, the organizational structures within ufology. Could we restructure things more effectively, taking things again back down to a more localized level? It's a very critical book, sometimes very harsh, I would say, but I think necessarily so. I think sometimes you need to kind of slap yourself in the face to wake yourself up a little bit and to refresh yourself. And I think that's the goal here.
But isn't the goal usually when you crack the egg to make something from it, not just to go in and crack the egg to say, look at how messed up it is?
Yeah, well, yeah, yes. The goal is to crack the egg here. But the goal is ultimately to ask the reader, individually and then, collectively the readers to do that for themselves, right? I mean, we are upfront about the fact that we don't have any definitive solutions to this. But if you're going to make any progress, the first thing you have to do is to acknowledge that there are problems. And most people just don't acknowledge that there are problems at all. So by highlighting the problems, we can then address them. And remedies and solutions are presented throughout the book by most of the contributors and by several in particular. Very practical remedies, in terms of how to approach witnesses, how to not lead witnesses, how to study UFOs. In fact, one of the essays by Micah Hanks is very practical, and he's actually proposing very ambitiously an entirely new classification system for UFO reporting, replacing the existing one that was created by Alan Hynek and expanded by Jacques Vallée and others. And so what Micah is doing here is he's sort of saying, look, the current classification system for UFOs as it currently stands is out of date, and it's actually by reframing that slightly, by using some new terminology, and by shedding some of the assumptions that existed within the previous classification system, we could actually make some progress. So he's actually putting together quite, I would say, a historic piece of writing there. Whether it will catch on, I don't know. But these solutions, these remedies, are being suggested throughout the book.
You find it's interesting to me, and I don't mean to interrupt, but as we look at science, science can't even get together on protocol. You've got different views of how we should look at medical science, at physical science, at geological science. It's, you know, you have different standards and belief systems of how these things should be looked at. And if you start to go outside of them, you will have scientists mock other scientists for opening the possibilities. And although they'll be openly mocked, later on we find out that that scientist that was thinking outside the box was right. And, you know, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, to try to get this fringe science of ufology to come together with one cohesive agreement on how do we progress with this, I don't, you know, I got the real sciences, the true sciences that are paid and money spent in can't even come to these definitive designs of how we should go about doing this.
And that's that is overall, that's not the goal of this book. Right. Individual essayists within the book, perhaps that is their goal, or perhaps that is their ultimate goal, not within the book, but generally more broadly, they would like to see what you've just described, a more cohesive and more cohesive approach to understanding the subject through scientific rigor, and that is argued for by several of the essayists in the book. Some of the other essayists, however, pretty much reject that approach or say that it's not applicable to this shifty phenomenon of UFOs. One of the essayists, MJ Benias, he says in terms of scientific approaches, he says, many of my colleagues in ufological circles would argue that it is essential for UFO discourse to move away from the theological and towards the scientific method. He says, I would agree with them. However, the razor cuts both ways, and the ideological mechanisms of the sciences can be as dogmatic as the religious tenets of the UFO believers. And that is certainly true. Science can be incredibly dogmatic and myopic. And I say in the introduction to the book, the goal is to shift and reframe the debate outside the prison of belief, yet also beyond the razor wire of scientific dogmatism. So it's sort of a middle ground, acknowledging that science doesn't have all the answers, but ultimately it could, but it currently probably doesn't. And so there is room for speculation, but when we are speculating, we need to be clear with ourselves and with others that that's what we're doing. We are speculating. We are theorizing. We don't have steadfast answers. And we need to, you know, I also say that understanding UFOs and related phenomena is a glacially slow process in its fetal stages, and that ufology would do well to accept and appreciate this. And that therein lies the freedom to explore and to learn. There's a lot more questions to be asked. Whereas I think that the ufology as it currently exists is, as I say, it's this disclosure mindset where we want answers now and we think that we've got them and we think that the government has got them, and all we have to do is pressure our leaders and that the answers will fall into our laps. And so it's a massive simplification of an incredibly complex social, cultural, and perhaps ontologically real phenomenon.
It may be that a new science is needed, a new scientific discipline. I like to think that psychophysics eventually might emerge out of this. I personally think it's so complex that it's going to require more than just hard science, but social science, even artists, musicians, all sorts of types of people and disciplines coming together in different ways. Maybe we'll produce better questions for us moving forward. But I think it's far too complex just as a science or a hard science alone can tackle at this point, because you're bringing in a lot of philosophy and it is a subjective as well as objective thing that seems to be going on. So it's going to require more than just one discipline, and perhaps a new scientific discipline that to tackle it on, I think. Well, that's just my personal belief.
I want to throw this question to both of you just out of curiosity, as I know many of our listeners around the world listening to this podcast will want to know as well. Robbie, where do you stand? If you push came to shove, you had to give an answer right now. What do you believe is going on? Are there multiple things at play here? Just give me kind of a loose structure of what you do believe.
Yeah, I My perspective is in line with one of the contributors, Miles Lewis, in the book, who says that he advocates for a multi-theory interpretation of the UFO phenomenon. You know, that there is no one explanation that accounts for all the data, that there are a number of things going on simultaneously. Now, included in those things, I think, is what you're encouraging me to say, is potentially extraterrestrial visitation. I am more sympathetic to the extraterrestrial hypothesis than probably most of the contributors to the book. But if I do rule extraterrestrial hypothesis into the equation, which I think it's credible to an extent, but my perspective is that it doesn't go far enough. It's too simple to account for the full depth of data that we're presented with when we really study the grassroots reports, which do, as Sue has indicated and as others indicate in the book, there are strong paranormal psychic elements to this, synchronistic things which just seem to be also directly personalized to the individual as well in a very profound way. Now, it could all be extraterrestrial, you know, but that would be a very simple explanation. I think it does us as subjective experiences, as human vehicles, I think it does us a disservice and injustice. We are capable of so much more than we realize. We're only just scratching the surface of ourselves, really. And so I think it would be foolish to remove ourselves from the equation and just to see this as something that's happening to us rather than something that we are intimately involved with in manifesting. So could extraterrestrials be involved? Yes, I believe they could. But again, I think it's far more multifaceted and complex than that.
Susan, what are your thoughts as we wrap up here? If you were pushed for one belief on this, where would you stand at this point right now in your history?
I tend to agree with a lot of the essayists and Robbie's interpretation in that right now I am a creative agnostic is how I label myself. If push comes to shove, I would say I am leaning more towards a co-creative process as well, being that the one tangible we have is a human being who is perceiving these things and experiencing these things. There is a potential that there is an alien other or some other intelligence. And there's no reason to assume it's extraterrestrial because all of this stuff is happening right here on Earth. Perhaps it's a multidimensional thing and that these things are existing or coexisting with us in this exact space, perhaps even this time, and occasionally something is happening that is allowing it to interact with us. I don't know. I'm very Jungian as far as Carl Jung's ideas on flying saucers went, that it could be a mythos, a myth that's come to life. Perhaps even it's the collective unconscious that we are getting our fairy tales and that coming back at us. I don't really know, but I am far removed from the idea of a nuts and bolts aliens coming to us in spaceships as the answer. Even if people are perceiving it that way, I think it's far more complex.
Yeah, I think.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt there. I think just to cap that off, what Sue said is if you were to put that same question to all of the contributors in this book, you would get the same answer, which is ultimately, we don't know. And I think that's what sets this apart from most other offerings in the field, which will offer you very, very solid conclusions based on an awful lot of assumptions.
UFOs Reframing the Debate is a collection of original essays exploring alternative perspectives on UFOs and how we might more usefully study the phenomena in the 21st century. We have a link up to that on our website. I want you to stay tuned right after this episode. You can get a taste for today's brand new True Crime Tuesday, The Foundling. This story needs to be heard. It has more twists and turns than an episode of Dynasty and Dallas combined, with General Hospital and Days of Our Lives. A story so intertwined and bizarre, it's something that only could have come from Hollywood, but it happened in real life. A little boy goes missing, brand new baby in 1964, and a child reappears in the East Coast 2 years later. that authorities believe is the missing child. Where his story goes from there is unbelievable. Stay tuned and listen to that. We want to thank our guests today, Robbie Graham and Susan Demeter St. Clair. Thank you both for joining us and spending
thank
some time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank we'll you. Look forward to speaking with you both again in the future. We've got a lot more great episodes coming your way. And remember to keep Timmy D in your thoughts and prayers to continue for his healing for his foot so that he can be mobile and back working here on the show on a regular basis. That's it for today. Thank you. Be kind. We'll be back again tomorrow here on Beyond the Darkness.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
There's nothing like sinking into luxury. At WashableSofas.com, you'll find the Anabay Sofa, which combines ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. And get this, it's the only sofa that's fully machine washable from top to bottom, starting at only $699. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash. Perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slip covers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabay has you covered. Visit WashableSofas.com to upgrade your home. Right now, you can shop up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at WashableSofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.